It is 2 p.m. and you are listening to Radical Minds on WHPK FM 88.5 Chicago, the pride of the South Side. Radical Minds investigates the interlocking political, economic, and social problems facing modern society for a ruthless critique of everything existing. We are an ongoing discussion of activists, academics, and intellectuals on issues pertinent to the left, past, present, and future. Catch Radical Minds every Thursday at 2 p.m. right here on WHPK. I'm your host, Erin Haygood, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Stephanie Gomez. Today we have two members of the Graduate Student Union at the University of Chicago, Chaz Lee and Danielle Palmer, here to talk about the recent unionization efforts at the University of Chicago and the future of graduate student unions. So thank you for coming on our show. And so the first thing I wanted to ask is that, you know, recently there's been an election for GSU, and I know that's been kind of an important victory. So I was wondering if you guys could kind of explain what, you know, the Graduate Student Union is, what the recent election was about, and just kind of what you've been doing.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having us. So GSU has been around since 2007 as a student organization at UChicago. And over those years, GSU has been an active part in advocating for graduate students on a number of different issues, including childcare and also working on the trauma center here on campus. And as you said, more recently, we've been on this campaign to have our union legally certified, which we just won. Hooray.
Mm-hmm. Yay.
And that process started about a year ago with the National Labor Relations Board ruling that we are employees legally. So over the past few months, we've been doing a lot of work to raise awareness and talk with our colleagues about what this union could take on in the future. And yeah, we voted recently, and it was a strong, decisive win, which is really exciting. And now we're just looking forward to learning more about the issues that we'll have to tackle and connecting with our colleagues.
So do you have any idea what some of these issues you might be facing in the future are? Could you talk about what you think might be some of, you know, the largest obstacles and how you might start to tackle them?
In terms of issues, one of the things that we're going to be doing next as an organization is to going out again and having those conversations with our membership, sending out bargaining surveys so that we can really determine what the issues are that our membership really cares about, what the things are that our membership would like to actually bargain for at the bargaining table. So these are all things that we will be talking about moving forward as an organization.
Yeah, the mission is really to be a fully democratic and member-driven group. So like Chaz said, that means continuing to have these conversations about what the issues are that are shared among all of our members.
Yeah, I think generally the most important outcome of the election, obviously, is that now we are a certified union with which the administration is legally mandated to bargain with in good faith. And so that means that we have, for the first time, a democratic body that is capable of not just collecting issues for membership, but also advocating for them through legally available means.
So you mentioned that GSU was first started back in 2007. I think, you know, a lot of people back in 2007 and maybe even today would say that organized labor and labor in the United States is in a weak spot. I was wondering if you thought, first of all, if the NLRB ruling kind of seemed to change any of that. Do you think that things are opening up for labor? And are there any kind of specific challenges for you all as a graduate student union organizing in an environment where labor organizing seems to kind of be in a weak spot?
Well, the ruling, of course, activated this campaign in a way that hadn't been available before. And part of what we've been working on has been communicating with our colleagues about our status as workers, because I think a lot of graduate students maybe don't see themselves as workers, given our academic freedom and our academic pursuits. So trying to build awareness about the work that we do as labor has been central to this campaign.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, part of the weakness of organized labor in America seems to be related to the decreasing importance of manufacturing jobs. There are many jobs that I think people usually associate with labor unions, like, you know, steel workers, car manufacturers. And I think that part of the challenge in higher education recently has been for academic workers, for the people that actually do the research and teaching. This includes graduate students, but also obviously adjuncts as well as tenure track faculty. I think part of the challenge in higher education has been for academic workers to start thinking of ourselves as people that do valuable work, that actually produce a lot of what makes the university possible in the first place, whether or not that's teaching or publication or presenting at conferences. And I think that moving forward, we'll continue to have conversations with people to really foreground that our work is at the center of what makes institutions like the UFC run. And I think part of our project is then to move from an awareness of the value of our work to a willingness and commitment to working together to making sure that the institutions are places that really take the interests of their workers into account.
So I'm wondering kind of about this relationship between, you know, being a graduate student as an intellectual and a student and being a graduate student as a worker, and particularly I was wondering why you think, you know, it's become so important now, especially to see graduate students as workers, because, of course, you know, kind of the large scale university with a lot of students, with a lot of professors has existed since the 60s. And so are there kind of any specific problems that you think are driving, you know, this real need to see graduate student work as work and not just as intellectual pursuits?
Yeah, we've come to a point where I think a lot of graduate students believe that they will be a tenured professor someday, and that's just not the reality. And by having this mechanism to take on an active role in shaping our workplace, I think will improve a lot of the uncertainty and anxiety that's behind the path that we're on as academics.
Yeah, I think a lot of academics across the board, not just grad students, but also faculty members, have been seeing long-term trends in academic hiring that have been trending more towards underpaid part-time researchers and teachers, rather than making sure that the hires are, you know, tenure track or just people that are people with adequate wages and benefits. And I think that for me, also one large scale trend that we've been seeing is also a trend that applies more generally to American higher education, in terms of decreasing access. So there are a number of articles published in various media sources that talk about how higher education in America has ceased to function as a way of closing the income gap, as a way of facilitating social mobility. And I think that these larger structural trends have been definitely contributing to how our schools are actually run.
So you talked about how part of the weakness of American labor today is kind of connected to the fall of, like, manufacturing jobs, kind of what would typically be associated with unions in the past. And then you've also talked about how these changes going on for graduate students are really part of kind of a larger change in how intellectual work is being treated, not only in the university, but in society at large. So I was wondering if you think that the unionization efforts of grad students here have any kind of relation to perhaps, larger efforts to unionize in formerly ununionized kind of sectors of the economy, like, for example, fast food workers or people doing other sorts of intellectual or service work. And I was wondering if you thought that this, you know, kind of broader context was important to any of your work in GSU?
Yeah, I think that generally speaking, not just in academia, but also people are, I think there is a hunger for more democratic institutions, right? For I think there is a sense, especially following last year's presidential election, that a lot of the electoral mechanisms that are currently in place are not necessarily adequate to really reflecting the desires that people might have to in terms of enacting change in their immediate workplace or at a larger level. So I think that unionizing, for us, unionizing graduate students, I think has been made possible in part because there has been this desire for people, on part of people, for more democratic institutions, starting with the workplace. And I think that, obviously, my personal hope is that we see this play out in other industries as well.
Yeah, part of it is, of course, bargaining for a contract that will hopefully improve our work conditions, but the other large part is creating the awareness and the comfort of having grad workers be able to talk about the working conditions openly and not having this taboo where we're just here because we're privileged to be learning and teaching and researching here.
So I was wondering about kind of the larger relationship of, you know, how you see your kind of personal work in GSU relating to perhaps questions often taken up by the left, just because, you know, kind of democracy has come up and these, you know, issues of where we think society ought to go. So I was wondering if you think that there is any sort of benefit to GSU being related to the left. Is it related to the left in any way? Do you think it ought to be? That seems like kind of an open question, and I just, you know, wondered what you think about that relationship.
I guess GSU will address what the members ultimately decide to address. Mm-hmm. So in that way, you know, we're not tied to a particular agenda starting out, but this ability to voice those opinions of the members freely and decide collectively what we want to take on, I think is hugely important for maintaining, democratic open speech in our organization and on campus.
And just to follow up to that, since you talked about this being a very, like, democratic-oriented union, how does leadership function in GSU? Because you just kind of spoke to, you know, decisions being made by everybody in the union. If you could just talk a little bit about leadership.
I mean, leadership structure is one of the many things that we will have to, again, deliberate on and decide as a membership moving forward. So I think that at this stage, it's important that we include as many members as possible in these foundational conversations. And so that's where we're at right now. We're really, our work is not over because we won the election, right? We have to go back, talk to people, really talk to as many people as we can to figure out not just what our priorities are at the bargaining table later on, but really what people are thinking in terms of fundamental questions such as what does our constitution look like, what do our bylaws look like, and part of that conversation encompasses what our leadership structure looks like too.
So I wanted to ask a question kind of about the university. Because, I mean, obviously they are your employers, they are the people, you know, that you now have the right to kind of collectively bargain with. And so I was wondering if you see the university as kind of the main institution that you have to deal with, or if you think that there are other institutions in society that are also kind of related to the problems that you might have as graduate student workers. I don't know how the university is dealing with this. Sometimes it seems, you know, when I read the updates that they try and kind of push off a lot of the issues onto, you know, other things. So I was just wondering if it's primarily a question of being able to bargain with the university or if there are kind of other institutions that you have to take on as well.
The immediate here and now is focused on the eventual contract that we'll bargain. And, of course, that'll be directly with the university. And there's also this broader tie-in of other universities that are at the same, going through the same process in private universities mainly, but also public universities that have had grad unions for many years have to renegotiate their contracts and keep fighting that fight. So there is a sense of more national solidarity with other grad workers around the country.
So speaking of these other grad workers, have you all taken kind of, are there any specific tactics of grad student unions around the nation that you think you've been drawing from? And kind of how do you see yourself as connected to kind of these more national chapters of graduate students?
We maintain regular formal and informal connections with various other graduate locals around the nation, but also more locally in the Cook County area. We're lucky to be surrounded with strong locals such as the, you know, our colleagues at UIUC and UIC pretty nearby. Our colleagues at Northwestern have recently been starting on their unionization campaign, and they recently came down and showed their support at our pre-election rally the Monday before the elections, and we're really looking forward to lending similar support and organizing with them on their campaign moving forward.
Yeah, and there's a number of other unions on our campus, like the library workers and others that are engaged in similar activities of rallying their membership, and we hope to continue supporting each other.
Okay, I also wanted to ask a question kind of about you as students being in a union, because obviously, you know, you're workers and you're working for the university, but you're also students and you're also intellectuals. And I was wondering if you, you know, on some level, and I was wondering if you thought that your intellectual work and, you know, that kind of activity that you do on a regular basis relates to how you've been going about forming GSU and how you think about the possibilities for something like GSU.
It's a big question.
Yeah, that's
a
good question. Yeah.
I guess it goes back to this idea of the ability to pursue intellectually whatever we want, and mm-hmm. universities have been the place for that, and hopefully will continue to be that place. And to be able to do that, we need some basic assurances, like knowing that we'll be paid on time and a decent amount, having basic benefits and access to resources, and extending the availability of those resources so that, you know, anyone can pursue science or humanities or whatever these intellectual pursuits happen to be.
Yeah, I think that a lot of institutes of higher learning are founded on, if you think about them, they're quite utopian principles, right? I think a lot of us want our universities to be places not just where wizened professors think their deep thoughts in the ivory tower, but a lot of us want our work here to have a real impact on the world through our students and through our research. And I think that being able to have a say in how these institutions are run, for me, goes directly hand in hand with these more lofty ideals that we might have regarding, you know, our ambitions for our teaching and research.
And maybe this question strays a bit off topic, but I was interested because you talked about kind of the ability to have a say in how, you know, the institution really is run. So I was wondering, one, if you see, because I know on campus there have been kind of a lot of other organizing efforts by a wide variety of students on this topic in, you know, through various different forms. I was wondering if you, you know, saw any relation of your activity to theirs. And then second, I was wondering, you know, if you could talk about how the grad student union not only allows you perhaps to, you know, get a better contract, make sure that you're being, you know, paid in a decent manner, but how it affects your freedom really to structure how the university is run and how students are getting an education.
I think a lot of GSU members are, you know, like a lot of us are active in various other venues too. GSU isn't the only thing that our membership looks to try to make a difference in our community, right? A lot of our members are also parts of organizations that represent minorities in their fields. A lot of us are involved in various other forms of community organizing or volunteer work, and I think that having a graduate student union, having a certified union on campus for graduate students means that there will be certain things that we are now capable of, that the administration is now legally required to check in with the grad students before moving forward, including basic things like wages and benefits. But our hope would also be to, depending on what our membership's priorities are, to introduce other aspects too into the process of collective bargaining that would hopefully have a positive impact on the overall direction of the institution.
Right, yeah, I was earlier going to say that there are a number of bodies on campus that students come together from different areas with faculty or admin to discuss improvements in policies and potential changes, and that's been going on for a long time, and I imagine it'll continue, and this is just one more avenue to continue to address our policies on campus.
And finally, I think this will be the last question, but I was just wondering how you think that the situation of graduate students as workers and as teachers, and also, you know, kind of the rise of adjuncts, what kind of effect you think that's having on the academy, on education, and on these kind of utopian ideals that you brought up that are really, you know, central to what a lot of universities at least purport to stand for.
I think that the current working conditions in academia are not very conducive for academic freedom. I think that the rise in undercompensated part-time adjuncts, for instance, that are appointed on a year-to-year contract basis, this means that a lot of adjuncts are, you know, they really rely on good evaluations, whether from students or from other committees, to retain their jobs. And I think that tends to limit the kinds of classes that people can teach. Oftentimes, at different institutions, you will see enrollment caps or enrollment requirements being enforced so that adjuncts are required to offer classes that will net the largest number of students regardless of their field. And I think that all these things tend to contribute to an environment where people are compelled to really worry about their basic security and about basic issues like income and being able to pay rent. And I think that really has a negative impact on the true diversity of ideas that are being able to be debated in the classrooms, but also in publications.
Yeah, and coming from the sciences, I've definitely seen increased discussion on mental health in among researchers. And I think it also goes back to the precariousness of our future jobs. And I think, there's been this larger trend in trying to more explicitly address the conditions that we're subjected to and what could be done to improve them for the next generation.
I just wanted to end on a slightly different note. We talked a lot about what the GSU and other graduate organizing efforts are doing in the present and how they're responding to the present. But I was wondering, how does GSU sort of engage with or take lessons from sort of the historical legacy of labor organization, both in the U.S. and internationally?
I don't think we'd be where we are today without the work that not just our predecessors did on this campus, right? I mean, we've been around since 2007, so that's a lot of work that people have done that we're no longer around to vote. But I think that we're also incredibly indebted to our peers at public institutions that have been fighting for grad worker rights, in some cases almost 40 years now. And I think that we're just joining a conversation about what it means to have an institution that really does work for its workers. We're just joining a conversation that has been going on for a long time in this country already.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Chasley and Daniela Palmer from the Graduate Student Union, and we want to congratulate them again on the recent election and their right to officially unionize and collectively bargain with the university. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, and now we'll do a public service announcement and an event announcement, and then we'll come back with the rest of our programming.
First, for a quick event announcement, if you'll just give me 1 second. All right. Coming up is a panel discussion on 1917 to 2017. This panel will be brought to you by the Platypus Affiliated Society UIC chapter. That's going to take place Monday, November 6th from 6 to 8 p.m. And that's going to take place at UIC Taft Hall. And for a quick PSA, how old can you be and donate the gift of life? What age is the right age to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor? The U.S. Department of Health and Human Service wants you to know any age is the right age to register. More of us are able to be donors and recipients into our 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. Learn more about donation. Find out about the lives you could help. Go to anorgandonor.gov or call 1-866-99-DONATE. That's 1-866-99-DONATE. And up next, we're going to be reading from an essay by Chris Catrone, who is a professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. The title of this essay is "The Millennial Left is Dead." And this was released pretty recently.
And are we going to do the recording that the author did?
We can do that, yeah.
Okay. So the author gave a teach-in at SAIC just a couple of weeks ago. And so we were thinking, you know, why not just play this recording of the article, you know, read by the author and with comments from the author, because, you know, that's more interesting than listening to us all day. So wait, give me a sec. Make sure. Where does it start? Does it start there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, hi, welcome. Everyone here is familiar with Platypus, more or less. But just to let you guys know about the regular activities on campus, the Thursday night reading group meets in which room?
517
in this building. And the syllabus is available on our website, platypus1917.org. And we also have a more informal meeting, the coffee break, on Monday afternoon, 4:30 at COSI at 116 South Michigan. Let me introduce myself first of all. So I'm Chris Catrone, and I'm presenting on an article that I wrote and published in the latest issue of the Platypus Review, issue 100, which also marks 10 years of our publication, going back to November 2007. And it's meant to be a bookend article on an article that I wrote for the very first issue of the Platypus Review called Vicissitudes of Historical Consciousness and the Possibilities for Social Emancipatory Politics Today. It's a mouthful. Otherwise known as "The Left is Dead, Long Live the Left." And in that article, I point out that sometimes the most urgent duty on the left is to declare that the left is dead. In other words, to mark a historical inflection point. And that's what I'm going to do in this article, which I'm going to read presently, and then we will discuss. So I start out with a few epigraphs from Leon Trotsky from the 1930s, from an earlier moment of the death of the left, from a couple of different articles that he wrote at the time. So let me read those to start off with. "Those who demand guarantees in advance should in general renounce revolutionary politics. The causes for the downfall of the social democracy and of official communism must be sought not in Marxist theory and not in the bad qualities of those people who applied it, but in the concrete conditions of the historical process. It is not a question of counterposing abstract principles, but rather of the struggle of living social forces with its inevitable ups and downs, with the degeneration of organizations, with the passing of entire generations into discard, and with the necessity which therefore arises of mobilizing fresh forces on a new historical stage. No one has bothered to pave in advance the road of revolutionary upsurge for the proletariat. With inevitable halts and partial retreats, it is necessary to move forward on a road crisscrossed by countless obstacles and covered with the debris of the past. Those who are frightened by this had better step aside. That's from a 1933 article that Trotsky wrote in the aftermath of the Nazi seizure of power in Germany, which the communists and the social democrats had failed to prevent. A little bit later in the 1930s, I have a couple of quotations from something that's been published subsequently under the title Art and Politics in Our Epoch. It's a couple of letters that Trotsky wrote to some of his fellow traveler intellectual sympathizers in the United States who edited and published the Partisan Review. They had friends, they had enemies, they fought, and exactly through this, they demonstrated their right to exist. The more daring the pioneers show in their ideas and actions, the more bitterly they oppose themselves to established authority, which rests on a conservative mass base, the more conventional souls, skeptics, and snobs are inclined to see in the pioneers, impotent eccentrics or anemic splinters. But in the last analysis, it is the conventional souls, skeptics, and snobs who are wrong, and life passes them by. The millennial left has been subject to the triple knockout of Obama, Sanders, and Trump. Whatever expectations it once fostered were dashed over the course of a decade of stunning reversals. In the aftermath of George W. Bush and the War on Terror, of the financial crisis and economic downturn, of Obama's election, of the Citizens United decision and the Republican sweep of Congress, of Occupy Wall Street and Obama's reelection, and of Black Lives Matter emerging from disappointment under a black president, the 2016 election was set to deliver the coup de grace to the millennials' leftism. It certainly did. Between Sanders and Trump, the millennials found themselves in 2015 and 2016 in mature adulthood, faced with the unexpected, unprepared. They were not prepared to have the concerns of their leftism become accused by Black Lives Matter. Indeed, Sanders and his supporters were accused by Hillary herself of being an expression not merely of white privilege, but of white supremacy. The millennials' leftism cannot survive all these blows. Rather, a resolution to Democratic Party common sense is reconciling the millennials to the status quo, especially via anti-Trumpism. Their expectations have been progressively lowered over the past decade. Now, in their last final round, they fall exhausted, buffeted by anti-fascism on the ropes of 2017. A similar phenomenon manifested in the United Kingdom Labour Party, whose momentum group, the Millennial Left, joined en masse to support the veteran 1960s socialist Jeremy Corbyn. But Brexit and Theresa May's election did not split, but consolidated the Millennials' adherence to Labour, as first Sanders and then Trump has done with the American millennial left and Democrats. All of us must play the hand that history has dealt us. The problem is that the millennial left chose not to play its own hand, shying away in fear from the gamble. Instead, they fell back onto the past, trying to replay the cards dealt to previous generations. They are inevitably suffering the same results of those past failed wagers. The left has been in steady decline since the 1930s, not reversed by the 1960s, 70s new left. More recently, the 1980s were a decade of the institutionalization of the left's liquidation into academicism and social movement activism. A new socialist party to which the new left could have given rise was not built. Quite the opposite, the new left became the institutionalization of the unpolitical. Michael Harrington, who lived from 1928 to 1989, his Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, established in 1982, was his deliberate attempt in the early 1980s Reagan era to preserve what he called a remnant of a remnant of both the new left and of the old Socialist Party of America that had split three ways in 1973. It was the default product of Harrington and others' failed strategy of realigning the Democratic Party after the crisis of its New Deal coalition in the 1960s. No longer seeking to transform the Democratic Party, the DSA was content to serve as a ginger group on its left wing. Despite claims made today, in the past, the DSA was much stronger, with many elected officials such as New York City Mayor David Dinkins and Manhattan Borough President Ruth Messenger. The recent apparent renaissance of the DSA does not match its historic past height. At the same time, Bernie Sanders was never a member of the DSA, considering it to be too right-wing for its purposes. The reason that I'm addressing the DSA here, by the way, is that they had a national convention here in Chicago, in fact, back in August. And they've seen in the last year, especially since the election, a huge growth, up to 30,000 members. In 2017, the DSA's recent bubble of growth, perhaps already bursting now in internal acrimony, because there were serious issues at the convention in the aftermath, is a function of both reaction to Hillary's defeat at the hands of Trump and the frustrated hopes of the Sanders campaign after 8 years of disappointment under Obama. As such, the catch-all character of DSA and its refurbished marketing campaign by DSA member Bhaskar Sankara's Jacobin magazine, Sankara has spoken of the missing link he's trying to make up between the 1960s generation and the millennials, is the inevitable result of the failure of the millennial left. By uniting the International Socialist Organization, ISO, Solidarity, Socialist Alternative, and others, in and around the way station of the DSA before simply liquidating into the Democrats, the millennial left has abandoned whatever pretenses it had to depart from the sad history of the left since the 1960s. The ISO, Solidarity, and SALT are nothing but 1980s legacies. Most of their members are my generation, 1980s generation. The attempted reconnection with the 1960s new left by the millennials that tried to thus transcend the dark years of reaction in the 1980s to 90s post-political Generation X era was always very tenuous and fraught. But the 1960s were not going to be refought. Now in the DSA, the millennials are falling exactly back into the 1980s Gen X mold. Trump has scared them into vintage Reagan-era activity, including standoffs with the KKK and the neo-Nazis. Set back in the 1980s, it and Stranger Things are happening again. If you guys have seen the original It, not just the recent It, right? So part of the history of the town that is revealed in the movie is the old history of the KKK in the community. The millennials are falling victim to Gen X nostalgia for a time before they were even born. But this was not always so. The founding of the New Students for a Democratic Society, the New SDS, in Chicago in 2006, in response to George W. Bush's disastrous Iraq War, was an extremely short-lived phenomenon of the failure to unseat Bush by John Kerry in 2004, and the miserable results of the Democrats in the 2006 midterm congressional elections. Despite the warning by the old veteran 1960s SDS members organized in the mentoring group, the Movement for a Democratic Society, or MDS, to not repeat their own mistakes in the new left, the new SDS fell into similar single-issue activist blind alleys, especially around the Iraq War, and did not outlive the George W. Bush presidency. By the time Obama was elected in 2008, the new SDS was already liquidating, its remaining rump swallowed by the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, FRSO, in a repetition of the takeover of the old SDS by the Maoists of the Progressive Labor Party after 1968. But something of the new SDS's spirit survived, however attenuated. The idea was that a new historical moment might mean that all bets are off, that standing by the past wagers of the left, whether those made in the 1930s and 40s, the 1960s and 70s, or the 1980s and 90s, was not only unnecessary, but might indeed be harmful. This optimism about engaging new, transformed historical tasks in a spirit of making necessary changes proved difficult to maintain. Frustrated by Obama's first term, and especially by the Tea Party that fed into the Republican congressional majority in the 2010 midterm elections, 2011's Occupy Wall Street protest was a quickly fading complaint registered before Obama's re-election in 2012. Now, in 2017, the millennials would be happy for Obama's return. Internationally, the effect of the economic crisis was demonstrated in anti-austerity protests and in the election and formation of new political parties, such as Syriza in Greece and Podemos in Spain. It was also demonstrated in the Arab Spring protests and insurrections that toppled the regimes in Tunisia and Egypt and initiated civil wars in Libya, Yemen, and Syria, and that were put down or fizzled in Bahrain and Lebanon. In Iran, the crisis manifested early on around the Reform Green Movement upsurge in the 2009 election, which also failed. The disappointments of these events contributed to the diminished expectations of the UNO left. In the U.S., the remnants of the Iraq anti-war movement and the Occupy Wall Street protests lined up behind Bernie Sanders' campaign for the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 2015. Although Sanders did better than he himself expected, his campaign was never anything but a slight damper on Hillary's inevitable candidacy. Nevertheless, Sanders served to mobilize millennials for Hillary in the 2016 election, even if many of Sanders' primary voters ended up pushing Trump over the top in November. Trump's election has been all the more dismaying. How could it have happened? After more than a decade of agitation on the left, in the face of massive political failures, such as the war on terror and the 2008 financial collapse and subsequent economic downturn, the millennials thought that the only way to move on from the disappointing Obama era was up. Moreover, they regarded Obama as progressive, however inadequately so. This assumption of Obama's progressivism is now being cemented by contrast with Trump. But that concession to Obama's conservatism in 2008 and yet again in 2012 was already the fateful poison pill of the Democrats that the millennials nonetheless swallowed. Now they imagine they can transform the Democrats, aided by Trump's defeat of Hillary, an apparent setback for the Democrats' right wing. But change them into what? This dynamic since 2008, when everyone was marking the 75th anniversary of the New Deal, is important. What might have looked like the bolstering or rejuvenation of social democracy is actually its collapse. Neoliberalism achieves ultimate victory in being rendered redundant. Like Nixon's election in 1968, Trump's victory in 2016 was precisely the result of the failures of the Democrats. The 1960s New Left was stunned that after many years protesting and organizing, seeking to pressure the Democrats from the left, they were not the beneficiaries of the collapse of LBJ. Like Reagan's election in 1980, Trump's election is being met with shock and incredulity, which serves to eliminate all differences back into the Democratic Party to fight the right. Antifa, really, exacerbates this. I'm always amused by this new American pronunciation of the term. Have you guys heard of Antifa? Eesh. The miseries of Anglicization. From anti-neoliberals, the millennial left is becoming neoliberalism's last defenders against Trump. Just as the new left went from attacking the repressive administrative state under LBJ in the 1960s to defending it from neoliberal transformation by Reagan in the 1980s. History moves on, leaving the left in its wake, now as before. Problems are resolved in the most conservative way possible, such as with gay marriage under Obama. Does equality in conventional bourgeois marriage meet the diverse multiplicity of needs for intimacy and kinship? What about the millennials' evident preferences for sex without relationships, for polyamory, or for asexuality? The millennials act as if politically correct multiculturalism and queer transgenderism were invented yesterday. as if the world was tailor-made to their sensitivity training, but their education is already obsolete. This is the frightening reality that is dawning on them now. Signature issues that seem to change everything, as Naomi Klein put it, such as economic shock therapy, crusading neoconservatism, and climate change, are sideswiped, ushered off the stage and out of the limelight. New problems loom in the horizon while the millennials' heads spin from the whiplash. Ferdinand LaSalle wrote to Marx way back in 1851 that, quote, Hegel used to say, in his old age, that directly before the emergence of something qualitatively new, the old state of affairs gathers itself up into its original, purely general essence, into its simple totality, transcending and absorbing back into itself all those marked differences and peculiarities which it evinced when it was still viable. Close quote. We see this now with the last gasps of the old identity politics flowing out of the 1960s New Left that facilitated neoliberalism, which are raised to the most absurd heights of fever pitch before finally breaking and dissipating. Trump, following Obama as the last phenomenon of identity politics, is not some restoration of straight white patriarchy, but rather the final liquidation of its criterion. If Trump is the standard bearer for straight white patriarchy, then straight white patriarchy is in serious trouble. The lunatic fringe races that get their last showing before achieving their utter irrelevance, however belatedly. Many issues of long-standing flare up as dying embers, awaiting their spectacular flashes before vanishing. Trump has made all the political divisions of the past generation redundant, inconsequential. This is what everyone, left, right, and center, protests against, being left in the dust. Good riddance. Whatever disorder the Trump administration in its first term might evince, like Reagan and Thatcher's first terms, there is much heat but little light. It compares well to the disarray among the Democrats, and perhaps more significantly to that in the mainstream established Republican Party. This political disorder, already the case since 2008, was the millennials' opportunity. But first with Sanders, and now under Trump, they are taking the opportunity to restore the Democrats. They may even prefer established Republicans to Trump. The millennials are thus playing a conservative role. Trump's election, especially after Sanders' surprise good showing in the Democratic primaries, indicates a crisis of mainstream politics that fosters the imagination of alternatives. But it also generates illusions. If the 2006 collapse of neoconservative fantasies of democratizing the Middle East through U.S. military intervention and the 2008 financial crisis and Great Recession did not serve to open new political possibilities, then the current disorder will also not be so propitious, at least not for the left. The opportunity is being taken by Trump to adjust mainstream politics into a post-neoliberal order. But mostly, Trump is avowedly a figure of muddling through, not sweeping change. The shock experienced by the complacency of the political status quo should not be confused for a genuine crisis. Just because there's smoke doesn't mean that there's a fire. There are many resources for recuperating the Republican Party and the Democratic Party organized politics. As disorganized as the parties may be now, the millennial left is completely unorganized politically. It is rather entirely dependent upon the existing Democrat-aligned organizations, such as minority community NGOs and labor unions. Now the millennials are left adjudicating which of these Democrats they want to follow. Most significant in this moment are the diminished expectations that carry over from the Obama years into the Trump presidency. Indeed, there has been a steady decline since the early 2000s. Whatever pains and adjustments to the grim new normal have been registered in protest, from the Tea Party revolt on the right to Occupy Wall Street on the left, the political aspirations now are far lower. What is clear is that ever since the 1960s new left, there has been a consistent lowering of horizons for social and political change. The left has played catch-up with changes beyond its control. Indeed, this has been the case ever since the 1930s, when the left fell in behind FDR's New Deal reforms, which were expanded internationally after World War II under global U.S. leadership, including via the Social Democratic and Labor parties in Western Europe. What needs to be borne in mind is how inexorable the political logic ever since then has been. How could it be possible to reverse this? Harry S. Truman called his Republican challenger in 1948, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, a fascist for opposing the New Deal. The Communist Party agreed with this assessment. They offered Henry Wallace, FDR's former vice president, as the better anti-fascist. Subsequently, the old communists were not, as they like to tell themselves, defeated by a McCarthyite repression, but rather by the Democrats' reforms, which made them redundant. The new left was not defeated by either Nixon or Reagan. Rather, Nixon and Reagan showed the new left's irrelevance. McGovern swept up its pieces. Right-wing McGovernites, the Clintons, took over. The millennial left was not defeated by Bush, Obama, Hillary, or Trump. No. They have consistently defeated themselves. They failed to ever even become themselves as something distinctly new and different, but instead continued the same old 1980s modus operandi inherited from the failure of the 1960s new left. Trump has rendered them finally irrelevant. But they are now winding up in the 1980s vintage DSA as the big tent, that is, the swamp of activists and academics on the left fringe of the Democratic Party moving right, is the logical result. They will scramble to elect Democrats in 2018 and to unseat Trump in 2020. Likely, they will fail at both. As the Democrats as well as the Republicans must adapt to changing circumstances, however, in opposition to Trump. But with Trump, the Republicans at least have a head start on making the necessary adjustments. Nonetheless, the millennial leftists are ending up as Democrats. They've given up the ghost of the left, whose memory haunted them from the beginning. The millennial left is dead.
And on that note, a public service announcement. A message from the American Lung Association. We all know someone who should get a seasonal influenza shot each year. People with chronic medical conditions, anyone over 50, pregnant women, children 6 months through 18 years, and people who live with them or care for them. In fact, anyone wishing to reduce the risk of contracting influenza should get vaccinated. Details at facesofinfluenza.org. And that was the show for today. We had on the Graduate Student Union, and then we had that passionate evaluation of the millennial left and, you know, its irrelevance. And, you know, something that really struck me, I think, between both of these is, you know, something that came up when we had, you know, the members of the GSU on was this idea that they wanted, you know, democracy, that this is about getting democracy. And, of course, you know, Chaz brought up Trump as someone anti-democratic. But I think, you know, when you take, like, kind of the long look at this that we got from that article, the millennial left is dead, you know, there's a question of, one, what is the content of these cries for democracy now? And two, what was the possibility for a politics based on the demand for democracy? Because, of course, I mean, that was the millennial left in, like, Occupy was, we want democracy. And that just kind of led to their liquidation. But then today, people either, one, call, you know, Trump anti-democratic, or two, they just give up democracy altogether and they say, well, democracy is the reason that we have Trump. And this was a bad thing. And so it becomes, you know, rather than something that is for changing society, right, a criticism of society, it becomes, you know, a defense.
Right. Yeah, it seemed like in the case of the GSU, a lot of the content of what they mean by a democracy is like organizational and institutional democracy. You know, they want to see like really just like the, you know, I guess like it means having all of the voices of the union being heard. It means,
I mean, like, I can see why they want that. I can see why that is
right,
a very decent,
solid liberal demand.
A solid liberal demand.
Right.
But then at the same time, there's a question of what...
And what I was saying is that it steps away from kind of this more complicated, like, question of democracy that is being posed with Trump now.
And that should be posed by the left. I mean, maybe it's not, you know, the responsibility of, like, a union to ask that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, they're there to collectively bargain for their wages. That's, like, fine, I guess. I mean, it's, like, whatever.
Right, but it's still political experience nonetheless.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, and I think that, like, you know, engaging with the question of the left, like, at large is, you know, important, but...
I guess I just don't know if the left is actually going to learn anything from, for example, the experience of GSU. Because, I mean, what we got from, you know, the article that was played, right, The Millennial Left is Dead, is, you know, kind of the successive liquidation of any sort of organization for preserving different lessons, you know, different mm-hmm. political experiences, that actually all of these are gone. And then, like, when you look at the DSA, well, what practically is the DSA? The DSA practically is telling the Democrats, so you don't have to learn a lesson, you know, about democracy. You don't have to think about, well, how can I demand democracy in capitalism? You don't have to ask that question if what you're trying to do is get the Democrats elected, because you don't need to ask that question. And so then, you know, kind of this work that the members of the GSU are doing, where they're trying to ask this question, okay, how do we run a university? How do we give people a good education? How do we deal with the fact that we're workers, right? Any of those lessons, you know, I mean, I don't know how much they matter to a left that is primarily concerned with getting rid of Trump and replacing him with anyone else mm-hmm. who is a Democrat.
Right. Yeah. You know? The question of is, like, is the way that they're taking up democracy going to fall on deaf ears with the left and the way they're taking up the question of democracy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely.
Right. Because those two things seem to diverge mm-hmm. from each other.
Yeah. So what to do? I mean, I guess new things are happening, and so that's, we should try and be learning from that. But I don't know that the GSU is really the new thing happening. I mean, this kind of call for democracy on campus has been happening for a while. And, I mean, it's kind of interesting that GSU is doing it instead of the students, because when the students do it, they do it as, like, well, we're customers mm-hmm. at the university, so you should do what we say. And when the graduate students do it, it seems a bit different, you know? It's about, mm-hmm. well, we want to provide an education, and we want these sorts of things. But the demand itself is actually, I mean, this, you know, he said it goes back to 2007. And, you know, all of these organizations on campus have been crying for democracy for that long, too. Mm-hmm. It looks like we're out of time. Yeah. So this has been Radical Minds on WHPK 88.5 FM Chicago. I'm your host, Erin Haygood, and I'm here with my co-host,
Stephanie Gomez.
And we'll see you next week at 2 p.m. on Radical Minds. Can you press play on that? I don't know how to do
it. Yes.
Thanks.
We'll be right back.